Were there other games that you wanted to cover, John?
There were one or two that I did notice particularly. Starting with a game against Cambridge University at Kingsholm, and one that Alistair Hignall tells stories about, where Cambridge came out with a sparkling back line and with players that had high aspirations to play for England, and they got absolutely hammered by Gloucester, 31-3. I think it was Alistair Hignall's first experience of the Shed, who christened him Alice. And
I've never forgot it.
Strange enough, we've stayed good friends, Alistair and myself. I think we had a tendency to bring teams like that down to our level. More than the exploiting their weaknesses.
Yeah, I think the problem was that their young centres, who had been cracked up to be England aspirants, came up against Bayliss and Jardine.
Well, that's
literally.
Literally, yeah. Just John Bayliss, forget Richard Jardine. I mean, you had two different players in Richard Jardine. Richard Jardine was quite quick.
But he was big as well.
And he was a big lad. Yeah. Well, he still is, yes. Yes. But as I said, Richard is... I mean, when I see him drop that goal at full flight, I mean, I just could not believe it. But when you got players like John Bayliss in the centre, Richard Jardine, Bob White in his day, and players like that, they were big players. You know, and teams in those days, you know, as I said, you know, I was 13 and a half stone. You know, they were much smaller players. When Keith Richardson and Mickey Burton stood up at the front of the scrum, my feet were 6 inches off the ground. But it was a completely different style of game then. You were actually scrummaging 6 inches off the ground. Mm. So it was unusual to see centres of that size, Mason. Mm.
Yes, it was, I think, perhaps even more than the centres, it was Alan Wordsworth at outside half who'd been actually nominated in that game as a likely England player. Got knocked backwards several runs in that game.
The plan was that if you could get to the outside half, you get to the outside half. Yeah. Scrum half, outside half was the forward's responsibility, basically. And you'd have planned moves where Yoker would come back behind the your own scrum half. And he would, if you take Rory Lawson now with his box kick in, the box kick, from our point of view, was you had to make sure that the scrum half or the outside half got the ball. Because as soon as they had the ball, they were actually put to bed, basically. And you know, that was the style of game in those days. Mm. The plan was that, you know, you had to get to the outside half, you had to get to the scrum half, just to make sure. If you were a little bit late, don't worry. Make sure he knows that you're there, so the next time he's going to be looking to take his mind off. There's a lot of mind play, even in those days, really.
Yeah.
The planning, you know, how you're going to manage players.
I think it would be interesting if you could compare and contrast, you know, hooking in the 1970s compared to, you know, what we see out at Kingsholm today.
I think the scrums today are ruining the game, and they shouldn't be under the laws. I mean, when you think about it, there was no law in the scrums. There was no height restrictions, and I said we could scrummage 6 inches off the ground. We were scrummaging 6 inches off the ground, and the scrum never went down. So when you start to think about that, and you think, well, why can't that happen now? You know. And I think what it is now, we've brought so much, we've bastardised the laws of rugby to a point where we need to go back to how it was. I mean, my thoughts of the scrum today would be that it should start off as uncontested. And you can't move until the ball comes in. And the ball has to come in straight. And the ball has to be struck by the hooker or prop, whatever it may be, by the front row. And we're losing so much time in the game of rugby now through scrummaging. It's starting to ruin the game. And if you see the way that scrum halves are putting the ball in, you have a line out and the ball goes 2 inches to one side, the referee blows up, not straight in the line out. But I don't think you can go through all sides. I don't think you see a ball put into the scrum straight once in a game.
No. And it astonishes everybody if it ever gets blown up.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a way of starting the game. Yeah. And it's becoming a bit like rugby league. If you take the line-outs out of rugby at the moment, the way that the defence lines up, it becomes very much like rugby league. Although, yeah, obviously you can play the ball and push the rucks in the mauls, and etc., etc. So scrummaging today, I obviously not being out there, but I would have thought scrummaging today is, apart from the physical side, is a little bit easier. But it is spoiling the game, I think. When you look back at the strength of the players and the size of the players going back into the 70s and 80s, what went on in scrums went on in scrums, but it was very rare you'd seen a scrum go down unless you really wanted it to go down.
Yeah.
You know, I would say 9 out of 10 scrums never went down. And you wouldn't want them to go down, you know. Especially, you know, the times you see penalties given away from a 5-yard scrum attacking scrum. A 5-yard attacking scrum, and the attacking pack gets penalised.
Mm.
You know, it's definitely a different game, the way it's being played today.
Changing tack again, Fred. Back in the 1970s, as a player, did you have any contact with the club committee? Or was that all through the captain sort of thing?
No, we had quite a few meetings with the committee. The committee was very... You had more relationship with the committee.
Yeah.
The committee travelled on the coach, stayed, if you stayed away,
yeah,
organised lunch and all those sort of things. So You had quite a strong relationship with the committee. Peter Ford was an England selector at one stage.
Yeah.
Peter was the one that come up to me one day. He said, Fred, he said, I got some good news for you. I said, what's that, Peter? He said, you've been picked for the England under-21s. I said, oh, thank you very much. He said, you don't seem very happy. I said, no, I'm 22. Perhaps I should have kept my mouth shut. there was a nice relationship with the committee.
Yeah.
And if you went on tour, you were all together. Yeah. It was a typical rugby club, really. It was the Gloucester was no different, really, to if you went round to Gordon Lee, Treadworth, Conehill, or anywhere else. Gloucester was run exactly the same.
Yeah.
The big difference was that in those days you had a rugby committee and a social committee, and never the twain would meet, basically. So, you know, when the professionalism came, it was hard for the rugby side to actually get involved with the finance side, for instance. And that was some major changes.
But how amateur was it, really, in terms of expenses?
At Gloucester, there was never... The only expenses you got at Gloucester was if you were off work injured and you didn't get paid by work. When we started going professional...
And was that from insurance?
From insurance.
Yeah.
Now, when we started going professional, in the amateur days, was a barrel of beer, a pair of boots... And that was about it, I think, and the odd tour.
Yeah.
There wasn't one penny that changed hands at Gloucester Rugby Club. amateur, it was amateur. And amateur to the degree that one of my first games in the one season was Cambridge University away, and Mike Nichols was self-employed, and he could not really afford not to do. He was working in Bristol. He could not really take the time off because you had to leave early in the morning to go and play at Cambridge University. So Mike Nichols was not available for Cambridge University. Because it was my first season, I lost a day's pay because I knew I had to take the opportunity of playing. So when you look at, I lost a day's pay, and I had a mortgage and everything else like that. Mike was the strong future captain and hooker, could not afford to take a day off. Now, if there was any money around, he wouldn't have had to do that, and I wouldn't have had to do it, you know. And there was never any money that passed hands. You go down to Wales. Myself and John Dix was sat in a Welsh clubhouse, and there was a young lad by the name of Lewis, scrum half, that came to Gloucester for a while, and I kind of think who we were playing against. I don't know, it was Bridge End, something like that. And this young Lewis, the same age as myself and John, was playing scrum half. And of course, after the game, he came and sat with us because we were the youngsters at the side. And we said, "You enjoying it?" "Oh, yes, 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 yes." And then one day a committee man came over and he just said, "Oh, thank you." Well, I think his name was, I don't think it was Alan, but there you are, Alan, there's your. And gave him a brown envelope. And as soon as he got this brown envelope, he got up and said, "Right, I'll see you two lads." And he was gone. Yeah. But Gloucester never. Which is a shame, really. No.